All right. So first of all, I wanted to thank Ben for doing a great job at kind of putting the thoughts together for this year. So if you get some time, make sure you thank him. Anything good that comes out of this weekend, knowing me and Josh, it comes from Ben. So thanks, Ben. You did a really good job with this. I'm really excited to talk to you guys about these things. I'm going to talk to you this morning about excelling in our love for one another. I don't ever give like my titles a lesson. I think that's just because I lack like the creative, you know, juices to be able to do that. I just kind of talk about a text and I just kind of let people make up their own titles. So because I was given a title, I wanted to say it up front because it was kind of exciting for me. Like, all right, I get a title. I'm gonna say it. But I couldn't keep it and act like it was mine. So, oh well, that's all right. I'm gonna ask you a question. I want you to think about this just for a second. You guys will study the Bible enough, you should be able to answer this in some way or another. If you were going to answer the question, who is in the New Testament the most talented and the most sacrificial church that you read about? What would you say? So think about the churches that are talked about. Acts starts with the church in Jerusalem. Talks a lot about the church in Antioch. If you look at the different letters that Paul wrote, the church in Philippi, the one that we're talking about this weekend, right? The church in Thessalonica. Well, those would probably be at the top of your list, right? I mean, if you think about churches that were most talented, had like the most talented Christians in it, and were the most sacrificial, right, you'd probably think something like that. Let me ask you kind of a secondary question. On that list, would you have the church in Corinth? I mean, you studied 1 Corinthians before, right? You've probably heard people talk about 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians is kind of like the black sheep epistle, right, of the New Testament. They're kind of the black sheep church in a lot of ways. When you think about the church in Corinth, what do you think about? Problems, right? Yeah, dysfunctional. They're just jacked up. If you were to, I sometimes imagine, like, what would it have been like for any of us to walk into one of the assemblies in Corinth? We probably would have watched stuff kind of go down and been like, what? This doesn't even look like church. This is weird. Like, this is some crazy stuff. And I mean, there was some stuff going on back then that just doesn't happen anymore, right? There were some spiritual gifts that were present then that aren't present now. And so maybe it'd be weird for that reason alone. But once you kind of got past that, once you got used to it, and you started, like, watching this church function, you know, I think we imagine Corinth as being this church that is just really, really messed up, kind of really dysfunctional. And I would imagine that a lot of the lessons you've heard growing up on the pew about the church in Corinth has kind of come from a negative point of view, right? Like, hey, don't be like the church in Corinth. Like, they were kind of messed up. If you're going to be like anything, be like the Christians like we're talking about this week. Be like the Christians in Thessalonica. Be like the Christians in Philippi. I mean, there's some really good things said about those people. Like, those are the kind of people that we should strive to be like. Isn't it funny that we kind of talk that way about the church in Corinth, yet one of our favorite passages in the entire Bible is what? 1 Corinthians 13, right? And it's funny the way that we read 1 Corinthians 13. I have talked about this a lot this year. As a matter of fact, when Ben sent out the stuff and I saw that two of the topics were on love, I was like, oh, okay, I got to talk about those because I'm talking a lot about 1 Corinthians 13 this year and love. And I was like, okay, I have a lot of stuff that I want to say about those two things. But this is something that I kind of figured out early on in the year, that we talk out of both sides of our mouth a little bit when it comes to the Corinthians. We're like, okay, they're messed up. They're like this totally dysfunctional group. But then when we want to talk about love, we go to like 1 Corinthians 13, and it's like, oh, be like this. I mean, this is like beautiful and wonderful. And have you ever been at a wedding where the guy gets up and he reads 1 Corinthians 13? Not all of it, by the way, because that would be weird in a wedding, but he reads, you know, we will not use it in context. He reads a little bit of 1 Corinthians 13, everybody's like, oh, that's so inspiring. Like, that's so beautiful. I wanna start by looking at the first, hold on, my little clicker's not working. Let's see if it works now. No? No?
Your mic turned off too.
Did it? Are you sure? All right. Well, maybe if I turn my mic on, my clicker will work. Nope. All right, I'm using my fingers. That's all right. If you look at 1 Corinthians 13 in the first three verses, Paul says, if I speak with the tongues of men and of angels but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give all of my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but I do not have love, it profits me nothing. Have you ever read this text and realized that half of these verses actually describes the Corinthian Christians? You realize that? When he says, if I have the gift of tongues, and I can speak in the language of angels, if I have the gift of prophecy, if I know all mysteries, if I have faith as to remove mountains, if I use my possessions to feed the poor, do you realize those are all things that the Corinthians have? We don't think about the Corinthians as being a group of faith, but they had to have been if they were Christians, right? They had to have been. They were a group of gifted people. They were a group of benevolent people. As a matter of fact, a lot of what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians is about the promises they had made to give a ton of money, is what it sounds like to me, to a group of Christians in Judea that were really in a bad place. They were super sacrificial. They gave all of this money. They were super gifted. As a matter of fact, contextually, historically, the Corinthians were probably a very young group. Corinth was probably, at the time that Paul visited the first time, about 50 years old. It was a brand new city that the Romans had built, and it existed strictly for the purpose of commerce. That means all of the people that lived in Corinth, there probably weren't a lot of old people. There weren't generations of families that lived there. It was probably all young professionals, very talented, very driven, very ambitious, that were there for one purpose. And it was probably a city that if you weren't good, if you weren't talented, you couldn't make it. You wouldn't have been able to stay in Corinth if you weren't a talented, driven, ambitious, climb-the-ladder kind of person. Now, this makes a lot of sense when you read the book of 1 Corinthians, that they had so many problems with wanting to be better than one another. You ever notice that? The book starts with them trying to one-up each other through their different teachers that they had encountered over time. This was kind of in their nature. This is the way that they were. And Paul says, you're talented, and you have faith, and you're sacrificial. Like, you give, you're benevolent, you do care about other people. And so Paul's saying, this is what you are. And this is the part where he says, this is what you're not. And I bring this up because I think a lot of times we read these verses 4 through 7, love is this, love is this, love is this, love is this. And they go, oh man, that's so beautiful. I want you to think that when the Corinthians read that for the first time, they didn't think, oh man, that's going to be the best text for weddings forever. They thought, oh man, we are dirtbags. We've got problems here. That's the way Paul meant it to be read. He wanted them to understand, like, you've got all of these things, but you don't love. You're not internally transformed by the gospel. The grace of God has not changed you the way that it was supposed to change you. Because if it did, you would be patient and kind, and you would stray away from things like jealousy. You wouldn't brag about yourself. You wouldn't be arrogant. You wouldn't be rude. These are all the things that they were also, right? And the things that Paul says they should have been, they weren't. And they had big problems. Now, here's kind of the interesting thing. I'm going to stitch this together with the idea of excelling still more. Because I think sometimes we make the same mistake that the Corinthians did. We think that if we possess talents, right? Well, tell me about your church. My church has got the best singing. We rock. We got like 1,000 people, and they're all so good. Right? Tell me about your church. Oh, our preacher. Unfortunately, my church can't say that. Our preacher is, you know him, right? His name is, and, oh yeah, you guys are so lucky. Our church has got all these people who do all these things. They're awesome. Paul says, if you got all the talents in the world, but if you're not transformed by the gospel, if grace hasn't moved your heart away from self-centeredness to other-mindedness, then you're nothing, is what he says. You are nothing. You think you're something, and you are actually nothing. A lot of times we think, wow, we've got all the talent in the world in my church. We support all of these guys. We've got all of these programs. We do all of these things. They're super generous, super benevolent. You know, that's the group in Corinth, by the way, just so you know. This should be kind of a scary thing to us. Because I think sometimes we think, well, to be pleasing to God, what do I have to have? I have to have talents, right? I have to be exercising my talents. I have to be doing the things that God wants me to do. I have to have faith, right? And I have to be generous. Those are the kind of things that we think about when we think about what pleases God. This group had all three of those things in some respect, and yet Paul says, God's not happy with you. God's not happy with you because you're not changed. Now, this is the text that I was assigned to look at. 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 9. I want to point out, I have verse 10 up there too, because I'm going to talk about that tomorrow. But in verse 9, he says, now as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you. Now, this is a contrast to what we just talked about with the Corinthians, right? I want to point out why it's different, though. The next part of this verse is the key to it all. The very next part of the verse, he says, you have no one to write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. Now, what does that mean? You're taught by God to love one another. I want you to think about that for a second. We're going to pause here for just a moment. You're taught by God. What does that mean? That, yeah, I've read the Bible, and there's all these commandments in the Bible to love one another. Is that what that means? Maybe. Maybe that's kind of the start of that. But that's not actually what that means. I believe what Paul's saying is you have learned from God how to love. Now, what this means is that you have first been loved by God, and through that love, you have learned to love one another. You know, this year we're at back home, we're kind of embracing this idea, you know, that God is love, right? And that probably makes some people nervous when you start talking like that. We can talk a whole year about how God is love. But really the thing that we're trying to embrace is that God wants us to be love. He doesn't want us to be loving. He wants us to be like Him, to be love. That people would see us and look at us, and that would be the primary description of who we are. It's our essence. It's at our core. It's where everything stems from. Because when we say God is love, that's what we're saying, right? God is love. Everything stems from God's love. Everything that He does comes from love. And that's what we have to learn to be. As a matter of fact, this is what Jesus was talking about in John chapter 13 and verse 34. A new commandment I give to you. And think about it, you've heard this before, right? That you love one another. Is that a new commandment? It's not a new commandment, right? That commandment had been around for a long, long time. God had said over and over throughout the law, throughout the history of the Hebrew people, that they were to love God and love one another. As a matter of fact, this is the opening, kind of the icebreaker for a lot of teachers that come to Jesus and say, what is the greatest commandment? And Jesus would always answer, and maybe this is like how they know He's legit or something, I don't know. Love God and love one another. Everything within the law hangs on these things. But Jesus, the new part of this, obviously, is that you love one another even as I have loved you. What He's saying is be loved and then be inspired to love. We can't love unless we're loved. And I think one of the problems in Corinth that was there, that the church at Thessalonica had figured out, according to chapter 4 and verse 9, is that they had to be inspired by God's love in order to love others. And the Corinthians were very self-centered in the way that they looked at all of their religious deeds, which is why Paul equates them to idol worship. When he says, if you do this, and you do this, and you do this, if you're just a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal, that's probably a reference back to idol worship. He's essentially saying, you have been unchanged. You used to worship in that idol temple downtown, and now you're assembling with the saints. But inwardly, like externally, everything's kind of changed. But inwardly, you're still the same person. You're still an idolater because your religion is about you. It's about you. Guys, listen to this. This is so super important. It's so easy to fall into this. It's so easy to grow up in the church, to sit on the pews, and just kind of do it because it's what everybody does and it's what you've always done. And it just kind of becomes kind of this self-sustaining religious culture that's not really about transformation. It's not really about seeing myself as I am and seeing the need that I have and seeing that God has filled that need and then being changed by that, being transformed by it. So I want to talk just for a few minutes about some specifics, like literally a few minutes, some specifics about like what is kind of one of the harder things about that transformation. If I was to ask you, what's the hardest thing about being a Christian? What would you say it is? What's the hardest thing about being a Christian? Somebody might say, well, it's this temptation or it's that temptation. I'm going to tell you, I think the hardest thing about being a Christian is forgiving. Really. I mean, really forgiving somebody. And having, maybe more importantly than that, having a heart of forgiveness. I want to read this parable to you, or the story to you, parable that it comes from a story that's interaction between Jesus and Peter. In Matthew chapter 18, verse 21, it says, "Then Peter came and said to him, 'Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him?'" This is after Jesus had talked about forgiveness, right? So Peter's like, all right, I got to figure some stuff out. And he says, "Up to seven times?" Jesus said to him, "I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven. For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. When he had begun to settle them, he who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. But since he did not have the means to repay, his Lord commanded him to be sold along with his wife and his children and all that he had, and repayment to be made. So the slave fell on the ground and prostrated himself," that's laying flat right in front of the guy, being as humble as he possibly can, "saying, 'Have patience with me, and I will repay you everything.' And the Lord of the slave felt compassion and released him and forgave him his debt." Now, as the story goes on in verse 21, it says, "But that slave," the one that was just forgiven that insane amount of money, "went out and found one of his fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii." That's about a third of a year's wages, right? "And he seized him and he began to choke him and saying, 'Pay back what you owe.' So his fellow slave fell on the ground and he began to plead with him saying, 'Have patience with me and I will repay you.' But he was unwilling and he went and he threw him in prison until he should pay back what was owed." Now, verse 31 is really key, I think. He says, "So, when his fellow slaves saw what had happened," I believe these are the slaves that saw the first interaction, right? They were all there in the presence of the king. They're paying back debts. They're giving account of how they've spent the king's money. And they see this great display of benevolence on the king's part, forgiving 10,000 talents, right? And so they've watched all of this happen. So when the fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were deeply grieved. That's why they're deeply grieved. And they came and they reported to the Lord all that had happened. Then summoning him, his Lord said to him, "You wicked slave, I forgave you all of that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not also have had mercy on your fellow slave in the same way that I had mercy on you?" And his Lord, moved with anger, handed him over to the torturers until he should repay all that was owed him. "My heavenly Father will also do the same to you if each of you does not forgive his brother from the heart." What's the point of this story? The point of this story, I think, is two things that you find in 1 Corinthians 13. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4, in the first part, it says, "Love is patient." Did you notice that was a key word in both of these things, both of these interactions? The one who owed 10,000 talents falls before the king, and he says, what? "Be patient. Be patient with me, and I will repay you." And so the king did what? He forgave him, right? The second interaction between the two slaves, same thing. Falls down before the one that he owes money to, the 100 denarii, and he says, "Be patient." But he doesn't forgive. In 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4, it says, "Love is patient." And then in the very next verse, it says, "Love does not take into account a wrong suffered." In other words, love forgives. Love forgives. So one quick key to unlocking this is kind of understanding the amounts. I'm not going to talk a lot about this, but if you think about what is going on here, this first slave that owes the king 10,000 talents, 10,000 talents, the average worker back in that time, from what I understand, would make 1 to 1.5 talents a year, right? So the average U.S. income is about $58,000. That obviously doesn't work in the Bay Area, but in other places in the world, and when you average in the U.S., and then when you average it all out, it's about $58,000 a year. You multiply that times 10,000, $580 million. Now, if you listen to the news a lot, which I'm sure you don't, $580 million doesn't sound like a ton of money, because we throw around numbers like that and kind of, you know, the nation's budgets and state budgets and all that all the time. But for the average person, that's about 200 lifetimes of work giving everything you owe that you made to one person, which is impossible. It's impossible to live that way. But that's kind of the number that Jesus chooses to represent the kind of debt that this first servant owes the king. It's an unpayable debt. That's the point, right? It's impossible. It cannot be paid back. You can't live 200 lifetimes. But one of the things that I think might be implied from this is that this servant is a servant directly to the king and directly answerable to the king, which probably means he was maybe a little bit high up, right, in this guy's government. And you don't lose $580 million in normal spending. You don't do it. That doesn't happen. Just so you know, when you grow up and you get married and you're doing like a budget in your home, if you ever find yourself $580 million in debt, you've done something horribly wrong. That doesn't work. Chances are he's incurred that debt either by mismanagement or corruption. Either way, he's guilty of not doing his job. I want to point out, I think that's the point in this text, is that we stand before a king and we've mismanaged or through corruption squandered, or maybe, I don't even know if that works, squandered everything that he's given us. That's what sin is. Sin is, in one aspect, taking everything that God is giving us and squandering it on our own desires. And that's exactly what this guy had done. And I'll also point out that if you run a kingdom the way that this king runs a kingdom, it doesn't work. If every time a person that's in debt to you, $580 million, stands before you and asks for forgiveness and you forgive it, you're going to go bankrupt really fast. Businesses don't work that way. Kingdoms don't work that way. The point of this is that this king takes a debt that is dangerous to the sustainability of his kingdom, and he absorbs it. He takes it on himself. Now think about who that sounds like. That's a lot like what we're told in Philippians chapter 2, how Jesus left his kingdom, and he didn't hold on to it. And he came here, and he endangered himself to absorb our debt, right? This is very similar to that language. And so this is the story that Jesus tells. Now, I want to quickly talk about why we need patience. Why is patience important? Why does God tell us that? Hey, be patient. Love is patient. You got to be patient with each other. The word patience is a compound word, macrothumio or thumos. It's two things, two ideas. One is to go long, right? Macro. If you have debates about evolution, you hear about micro and macro and all that, or economics, micro and macro. It's to go long and to have an angry temper. The idea is, as it's translated in the King James Version, I often reference this and say that it's a good way of translating things, but the King James says that it is long-tempered or long-suffering. That's how, in the King James Version, this word is often translated. The idea is to have a spiritual patience that bears injury, or in this case, debt, without melting down. That's what the slave asked for, right? Please don't freak out. That's what he's saying. Please don't freak out. Have patience with me, macrothumios. Please don't get mad. Okay? I'm going to show you a number. Don't freak out. Right? He shows him the number, and he doesn't freak out. You know, suffering comes upon us without choice. As a matter of fact, unless you're one of those weirdos that likes to work out a lot, you know, or you're a gymnast, I know there's a couple of those in here, you like pain, you're kind of one of those weirdos, none of us really bring suffering upon ourselves, right? Suffering is something that just happens, but patience is the thing that kind of takes us and puts us in control of our suffering. Patience essentially says that on one hand, We're going to accept this suffering. We're not going to... If I'm patient, I'm fully embracing the fact that I'm suffering, right? Or else I don't need patience. If I'm lying to myself, telling myself I'm not suffering. If I'm patient, I'm saying, all right, I'm suffering. I'm not denying it. I'm not running away from it. Which, by the way, you know, in churches, I think sometimes we're kind of taught to do this. We think it's a sign of strength. When you're really going through something hard, someone's really hurt you, or something has really hurt you, and someone comes up to you and they say, hey, how are you doing? What are you supposed to say? I'm good. I'm God. I'm good. I'm God. God is good, is what I meant to say. Don't say that. It'll really freak people out. I'm good. God is good, right? That's what we're supposed to say. That's kind of what we're trained to say. But you know what? If you're a patient person, you don't do that. Patient people embrace the suffering. They realize this suffering is real. It's real. It's really going on in my life. But on the other hand, it also is that thing that doesn't melt us down. In other words, it doesn't define us. When you think about the picture of melting gold down, right? You go out, you dig a bunch of gold out of the earth, and you take it, and you put it in a crucible, and you melt it into a liquid form, and then what do you do with it? You pour it into a form. Because everybody knows if you've got a brick of gold, you're way richer than if you have a bunch of flakes of gold, right? So I want my brick of gold. And that's the picture here, is melting something down into a form. And when you have patience, suffering comes. You can't avoid it in life. This is the way that it works. But you don't allow it to mold you. You don't allow it to form you. The particular long-suffering that Jesus is talking about here, though, in this story, goes back to the original question, right? The original question from Peter is about forgiveness. And did you notice, like in 1 Corinthians 13, Jesus connects the idea of patience and forgiveness. He says, be patient with me, and I'll pay it back. And the king is patient, right, in the form of forgiveness. I want to suggest that you can't have really one without the other. You can't be a patient person unless you're a forgiving person. It's something that you have to have to be what God requires us to be. Let's talk a little bit about what patience is. There's two things real quick that the king does here that I think shows what patience is. Number one is he forgives the debt. Let's talk about this for a second. When someone hurts you, let's be honest, something's created in that, isn't there? It's pain. It hurts, right? And there's a kind of debt that is, like the parable is teaching us, there's a kind of debt that kind of is created. It's a pain debt. And we seek payment for that pain debt through what the Bible calls vengeance or revenge, right? I want to get revenge on that person because they hurt me. Why do we do that? What's the reality of why we do that? It's on the board. The answer is there. You can just read it. We do it because it feels good. That's why we do it, right? We learn at a really early age, probably with our brothers and sisters, right? Your brother or sister comes along, whack! Oh, yeah? Whack! And when you hit them back, it feels so good, doesn't it? And you know, I was told a lie a lot growing up, and that is, don't ever take vengeance because you'll never feel good. You'll never feel truly good. You know, that's not true. As you grow up, what you'll find is that you actually can hurt somebody back so bad that it kind of takes care of the problem. Like, you actually start feeling good. It's not true. I'm just telling you. I don't know who's going to tell you this in your life, but I'm just telling you. It's not true that you'll never feel good if you enact revenge. You will. You'll feel good. You'll feel good immediately, and if you do it enough, you'll feel good. You'll kind of take care of the problem, where you'll actually begin to feel sorry for the person that you're victimizing in your vengeance. Like, you'll enact revenge so much that you'll start feeling bad for them, right? Because they're hurting so bad at your hand. But what the Bible warns us about in this idea of macrothemios is that in the process, it will change you. It will change you. And it will turn you into the kind of person that you never thought you could be, and the kind of person that you never wanted. It'll turn you into a vengeful, spite-filled, angry individual. That's, it will mold you. And that's the warning that God gives us. And the idea of patience is to not be formed into the image of hurt, right? But to withstand that, to overcome that. Forgiveness and patience, when you kind of push these things together and mold them together, you begin to realize that it's not taking revenge, but rather it's paying the debt. That's what Jesus teaches us, is that we actually have to pay the debt. Now, what does that look like? Paying the debt most of the time when someone has hurt you? Just real quick, just raise your hand if you've ever been hurt by somebody. Okay. I probably should have started that way. I mean, think about that. Every one of us, I didn't see any hands come up here. Because we live in a sinful world. And that's the way that it is. And sin hurts. It victimizes. So we've been hurt and we have hurt. The only way to fix that is to absorb debts. What that means is you deny yourself some things. You deny yourself the pleasure of insults. You deny yourself the pleasure of gossip. You deny yourself the pleasure of slander and demoralization by taking the high road. Have you ever done that before? I've done that. Where someone hurts you, You have an obvious opportunity to everybody in the room to enact some revenge. You say, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take the high road. But in your heart of hearts, you know you're taking the high road as a way to enact revenge. Right? I'm doing that to make you feel smaller. I'm doing that to show my superiority above you. And that's not what God tells us when he talks about the idea of heaping coals upon people's heads. He's actually talking about true forgiveness, which is an absorption of that debt. Here's the reality of it. Like you weirdos that like being a gymnast or working out, in order to do that, you have to go through real pain. Real pain. Here's what this means. Is that someone's going to hurt you in your life, and guess what? In a sense, they get to hurt you 1,000 times more. That's kind of scary, I know. But I want to suggest to you that's exactly what Jesus signed up for. Jesus went to the cross and he died so that I could become his child who would never sin again, right? Nope. Jesus went to the cross and died so I could become his child. Maybe try my best to sin less, but pretty much every day I'm going to put him back up on that cross. And you know what his promise is to me? Is he's going to continue to absorb my debt. And you think that hurts God any less every time we sin just because Jesus isn't physically on the cross anymore? I think if we think that, we're wrong. And so this is going to cause us pain. It's going to hurt. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but also this all kind of stems from this kind of deep compassion that the king feels for this guy, right? You know, when someone wrongs us, we begin to stress the differences. You do this? I do this. Someone hurts you? I wasn't just looking at you. She got freaked out just right now. She's like, you know? You know I do. Who told you? When someone wrongs us, when someone hurts us, we begin to stress the differences between us and them. You know, I'll tell you what. One of the things that makes me want to, like, be violent towards people, which I don't have this very much anymore, but there are times that I want to, like, make a whip and clean out somebody's temple. When people look at me and they say, I would never do that. And it usually is in the context of one of my faults. I would never do that. Man, I feel like cleaning someone's clock when they say that to me. You know why? It's because I see what that person doing is they are stressing the difference between them and I. Why do we do that? Why do we stress the difference between ourselves and someone else? Why would we ever do that? We do it because we need to feel a sense of superiority. Right? And when someone has hurt us and we're unwilling to absorb debt, what we begin to do is say, well, I'm not like that person. And we begin to think of them strictly by their infraction. Right? Someone brings up their name. You ever done this before? Someone brings up a name of someone that's hurt you and the person's not around. And you say, that person's a fill in the blank. And it's almost always the infraction, right? If that person has lied, if that person has cheated, if that person has stole from you, you say, that person's a liar. Is that person really a liar? I mean, is that, like, that's who they are? Like, every word that comes out of their mouth. Now, that some people, I guess, are actually like that. But when we do this, we do it because what we're doing is we're developing an identity of ourselves and that person in our thinking. Right? We begin to develop a difference between us and them. This reminds me of, have you ever gone, like, to Disneyland or Magic Mountain and you walk by those booths and the guys are drawing cartoon figures of people? I meant to ask Danny. Danny and I had this done one time together. If you can imagine. If you can imagine without, I'm sure you can, actually.
They're amazing.
They are amazing. Yeah, maybe Danny has the picture somewhere and he can share it with us sometime. I mean, it's hilarious, right? The whole point of those things, really, is, by the way, if you're ever going to spend money on this, I just want you to understand up front what the guy's doing to you. The whole point of that is to make you look kind of stupid. I mean, that's, and you got a little bit of a nose, it's like, whoo, right? Maybe your ears are a little bit bigger than average, it's like, The whole point is to make you look like a fool. And this is what we do in our minds with people that have hurt us. Is we begin to say, their ears, right? They lied once or they lie occasionally, and now they're liars. And we tell that story so that we can distance ourselves from them and feel justified at taking revenge. And that's the opposite of absorbing debt. And instead of that, this king feels compassion. This king doesn't stand up and give a lesson about how much better he is than his subject. You know, God can do that every time we sin. God could like show up every time we sin and be like, you know what, I would never do that. And he's right. Like when the rest of us say it, it's a total lie. But when he says it, it's totally true. He could do that every time. And he doesn't. You know why? Because he's in the business of taking debt on and absorbing it on our behalf. How do we get it? This is it, last point, I promise. There's grown-ups in the back room pacing because I'm taking. How do we get the patience? How do we do it? It's in the story. In the story, there was an expectation that being forgiven by the king would empower and obligate that first servant to forgive his fellow servants, right? Now, I use those words very carefully. I'm not always real careful with my words, but these two words are really, really important to me. There was the expectation that being forgiven by the king would both empower, and another word you can use there is inspire, and obligate. Do you realize when you take the grace of God that's offered through Jesus Christ, that for the rest of your life you're morally obligated to forgive people? You should think long and hard about that if you haven't become a Christian, because that's the deal. As a matter of fact, this is the one thing where Jesus says, like really says, I will take my grace away. The Sermon on the Mount, when he's teaching us how to pray, remember that? He says, help us to forgive our debts as we have been forgiven our debts, right? Or help us to forgive our debtors as we've been forgiven of our debts. And then at the end of the prayer, Jesus goes back to it, and what does he say? Out of all the things he could talk about in that prayer, he goes back to forgiveness, and he says, if you don't do this, we won't forgive you. We won't do it. We'll take it away. We're morally obligated. And I think when you think about that, the more it makes sense. We're kind of dirtbags when we take the grace of God and then don't give it. Because what the king hoped is that the smaller debt would be put into the context of the greater debt. Right? That's the whole point. There's 10,000 talents and 100 denarii being talked about in this parable. The smaller debt, which is a joke in comparison to the larger debt, the smaller debt is supposed to be put in the context of the larger debt. And when we don't do that, here's what we do. We become the king. We become the king. You know, here it is, guys. You can have all the talent in the world. And I believe that you probably do. I listen to you sing. I hear you guys pray. I've been now, I don't know, I can't remember how many years I've been here, sitting in these conversations that are about ready to happen, listening to your observations. You're extraordinarily talented. Ben's absolutely right in that assessment. You're extraordinarily talented. And I believe you have faith, or you wouldn't be here. I believe in the sense that you can be, you're sacrificial. But like the Corinthians, if you don't have love, if your heart hasn't been transformed by the love of God, by the grace of God, then all that's for nothing. All that's for nothing. And in a sense, when we live our life like that, we live our life as a king, in a position that only the king deserves to be in. But here's the thing, someday we're going to actually stand before the real king. And we're going to have to give an account of the debts that we owe. And I want to stand before the king having forgiven as many debts as possible, as many as possible, because I know if I haven't, then he won't forgive mine. So just some things to think about. All right. Thanks, everybody. It's going to be a short discussion, by the way. So afterwards. That's all I got. Thank you.